Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And I'm Philip Sage with ARMS Reliability in Australia.
Hey, Philip, you know, we just did a reliability test, I cert. We jinxed ourselves. We were swapping war stories about using dial-up modems and business traveling and all the adapters we had to carry and all that other stuff. And then
all that stuff.
We said, oh, let's hit record. And then we lost it. And it was like, what's happening? It should just work. So anyway.
Well, it should. It should. And the world today has got so many neat features that have been tried and true and drips of blood all over the world by travelers and globetrotters like we used to do that you just wonder how come it doesn't work. But boy, it used to be a heck of a challenge.
I don't know. Back into those old stories, I've never sat in a hotel lobby and then have like a page go by with a message board saying message for so-and-so, you know, kind of looking for people in the lobby. I've never been in a place that did that.
I've actually had messages and envelopes waiting for me when you return to the hotel. You know,
you pick up your keys and they give you an envelope
for dinner or, you know, those types of things. So it's the way we used to do it. Was a lot different, and you know, pre-pagers, pre-cell phones, pre-internet, pre-computers, the world of business still survived, and we now have these modern conveniences that perhaps we rely on too much. And as the glitch a few moments ago, when you hit record and everything went poof, shows us that the world still has a ways to go in the field of reliability.
Oh, yeah, so. Definitely. So, well, I'll call. And I actually know virtually met the creator of Zencastr, which we're using to record this. And he's a very personable guy and very interested in, you know, what was working and not working. And he even called me back saying, hey, can we spend some time debugging this? And so I thought that was a good sign for his company that he's willing to dive into it and keep learning it.
Somebody that's definitely passionate and, listening to the user base and trying to get that feedback and improve the reliability and not just working in a vacuum, you know, is really is learning from the user experience. And that's a good sign.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So we were chatting a little bit about, you know, I know that you teach and I'm drawing a complete blank of what university it's at.
Central Queensland University.
Central Australia. So good thing I didn't say the one I was thinking of. That's the other side of the country. And that other state.
The folks over at CPU would be rolling over and saying, oh my gosh.
But you'd mentioned something about, you know, at some point you teach, and I think my immediate comment back to you was, well, we seem to have to teach reliability engineering all the time. And so I was wondering what you were alluding to, and you kind of commented about how to go about teaching or being ready to teach, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, it's a tremendous subject, and I'm sure there's many more learned people than myself that have in the academic world that have opinions. But to teach reliability, we teach that at all levels, and that might just be talking or explaining what you're doing and collecting data up through. Making a presentation to your manager or his manager or their manager, you know, as you go up, so that you put the whole topic in context through the industry wide delivered courses that are out there on the subject of reliability, which I've taught and I believe you've taught through the CRE program, similar type courses, and then of course there's the truly academic university levels where I've got most of my experience. Can't speak to grade school, high school type of learning, but you know, the thing that I have learned and that I try to strive towards is that when you get the opportunity to teach somebody, there's a lot of things that you need to make sure you've got prepared in order to enable that learning experience for the student or the person that is your target, so that they get the information and they walk away feeling comfortable. And certainly within the university level, at the master's level, we're looking for that learning to not only stick, but to be demonstrated through some reliability projects that we do midterm. So I think a good topic that everybody would really probably be interested in is, what does it take to teach reliability at a high level? And we probably, in our 20-minute sessions, probably can't focus on every instance that I've just mentioned. But for me, the prototypical course that's delivered in industry might be a place to start. You know, what constitutes a good manual? What constitutes a good slide deck? What's a good topic? How many exercises do you break it up? You know, those types of topics. So, you know, feel free to jump in on any of those and or suggest some other areas that we can focus on, because I think they'd be very valuable for anybody trying to organize a training session on a topic of reliability.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, I think what you're talking about, and it doesn't only apply to teaching at a university level, but I think the takeaways what we do there apply. I work for one person that, and she would say, all right, you teach a class on design of experiments, and you teach a class on SPC, and you teach a class. And it was a way for us to become aware of a broader range of tools that we were using on this factory floor. And it, being in charge of having to teach it, has struggled with the, well, one, learning it quick enough so I could teach it next week, kind of thing.
You don't truly learn a subject until you try to teach it and realize that you didn't know all of the nuances. And I think you don't really learn a subject until you've taught it two or three times, when you've been confronted by some really good questions from some switched on students. So it's a journey, and it has certain things I think that you need to consider having in place, especially if you're going to invest all of your time and all of the students' time. If you've got a classroom of 25 people and you're going to go for 2 days, that's 50 man days of time that you're going to potentially waste away if you're not well prepared. So, you know, how do you get well prepared? You need to understand the subject. You need to have a very good teaching plan laid out, preferably a manual with exercises that help lead the student towards a better understanding of the subject. Today, everybody seems to use PowerPoint slides, however, or at least something similar. You know, back in the day, we had our you know, different slides, but we put them on the overhead projector one at a time. You know, you didn't use a computer. And that meant that you had to really be thoughtful about what it was that you wanted to produce, because you had to actually create those slides one by one, and while it was on the projector, you would actually mark on it with a magic marker to highlight specific areas. You're laughing. Yeah. I know.
So, I know. I used to do that. I would put little tick marks on my slide of where I wanted to draw, like axes, and draw curves, just demo stuff, so that I could draw, you know, create reasonably straight lines and remember what I was trying to draw there. I put little cheats on the slide that then I would fill in. And if it was an axis, I'd pre-fill it in. But if I knew I wanted to show a shallow slope versus a steep slope, I also always had multiple decks or slides, foils available, so that I could, that's a good question. Let me pull up a blank and I'd draw.
Yeah.
And I found when I was first learning to use PowerPoint that I was standing there, you know, waving my hand trying to draw on it, because I would explain it while drawing. And showing graphics and show nuances that I hadn't thought about. But it's that switched on student that asks the question and goes, oh, yeah, that's a good point. Let's look at it this way. But being able to know your tools well enough to, one, the subject well enough, but two, the tools well enough that you can convey it.
Yeah.
I found that know the tools is probably a underpinning of this one that we don't have to dwell on a whole lot. But I mean, you outlined some of the fundamentals, right? Just the, you know the topic, have a plan of how you're going to introduce the terminology, the concepts that build on it, have examples so they can take it away, process it, stuff like that. I think of that as a block and tackling, whether I'm teaching my peers, you know, when yeah. I'm somebody in the hallway asks me a quick question, I've always learned or found valuable to know, well, where's my audience? You know, what does she know or not know? Where do I start? Because if yeah. I start in the beginning, there was two numbers and eventually they invented a zero. It's probably not going to get to an answer that's meaningful to the person that asked me the question or that student. But if I start at, oh, let's just start building on top of calculus and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
But if they aren't fresh with that, then I've lost them right off the start. So some of it is understanding the audience, which you didn't mention.
Exactly. Exactly. And at the, from my travels around the globe, that gets another dimension gets added onto it when you teach in another language, or you try to teach a hybrid class, or try to teach through a dedicated translator. The challenge that in several of the other, certainly in the Southeast Asia countries, I've run into this, and there's nothing that I mean in a derogatory way about the very fine people there, but not everybody reads and writes the local language or reads and writes English. They can speak mm-hmm. it, but they can't necessarily read it. So I've been in, unfortunately, some courses where students have pulled out their smartphones and been using those for on-the-fly translation of the manuals or the exercises, trying to get mm-hmm. an understanding of what that exercise means. And that's absolutely the wrong position to put that student in. We need to anticipate those types of things that, you know, that we're pitching it at the right level, or we're backing up, you know, when we've got a very diverse, informed class, that we're not backing up to such a low level of the basics that we're disenfranchising the true experts who want to start at calculus and build. But at the same time, if you've got somebody that has never been to calculus, attended at the university, never, and more importantly, in that subject, probably never really mastered enough of their calculus to be able to recognize what those squiggly lines and summation operators and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. then you're equally going to lose the person, just as equally as if you're putting up a slide in a different language. In the right, a romantic language like Italian or French or German, that they at least have a chance as an English reader of understanding. What else?
The character set is. Yeah, no, I made me think of I was talking to a woman that goes around the world teaching cultural awareness, and she published a book, and whoever created the book title or the book cover used a hand gesture of okay. In the U.S., it's the thumb and forefinger together making a circle with your fingers up.
Yeah.
Right? And in Brazil, that's a rude gesture.
Ooh, okay.
And so that's the first place. She had just got her book. She hadn't seen it before. She's handing them out, and they're all laughing. And she goes, what's going on? And she saw the book and goes, oh. They picked that photo. In the first place I have it is in Brazil, where it doesn't mean what we thought it meant, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I found that early on when I was first internationally traveling, the corporation would offer us, and it was like a short video set or a book that we would get, depending on where we're going, of cultural norms, like how to exchange business cards in Japan.
Yes. Yes. Right?
Which is completely different than the U.S.
Completely different.
Completely different. And what different colors meant. And so if you're doing your slides and you wanted to warn somebody, red's not always the right color.
No.
You know, but there's so many little things like that. And they had booklets and training pieces, depending on how intensive you were going into it. But paying attention to some of the cultural norms but I think it applies to how people learn too. Some people learn by practicing it and struggling with it.
Exactly.
And some people learn by hearing it and then they process it and think about it and then they'll ask some questions. Others want to get into a discussion. Different people learn in different ways. And that one, I think there are cultural differences around the world that affect that. But even within any group, some people are going to not be able to look at you in order to listen because their visual distracts them. you know, so if they're looking at you, they're just, they get distracted and they're not processing what they're hearing. So they look away. It's not that they're not paying attention, but that's a whole topic in and of itself, right? Is dealing with the cultural stuff and different ways people learn. But I think we've talked about understanding where the student is, and there's going to be a range of people if you have 25 people in the room. I think what we're saying is you need to know your topic well enough and enough about education and how to transfer information to other people to blend those two.
So that's the key. That's absolutely the key. And all those cultural aspects may not apply to some of our listeners that are, you know, living largely within a country and a established culture, because those are things that you're used to. But if, as you travel the world, you run into the ways that people have learned is not necessarily the way that we have learned or you have learned. And that is something that you have to be very conscious of. And in fact, when I lived in China, the whole training approach, because that in general, and I'm just speaking in, you know, stereotypically in general, the Chinese that I was working with had gone through school by learning things by practicing, as you'd mentioned before, and not by learning a concept and extending that into, you know, how to build a bridge, that I want to build a bridge across the river from here to here. And that's your job, Fred. But if I want really to teach that differently, to give a very clear example, I have to show you exactly how to dig the foundation, how deep, how much concrete and rebar to put in, what type of steel structure to build, what kind of decking, what kind of side rails, what color paint, and how to apply those. And if I teach it that way, then it gets very well, it's very well received and understood in certain cultures. Whereas if I teach it more of a Western way, where I give you the concept that I want to build a bridge and I expect you to take your life experience with bridges, whatever that may or may not be, and extend and challenge yourself, that seems to fail miserably in many courses that and presentations that I've been or witnessed. So I think you're absolutely right. And the fundamentals of having a cohesive manual for the student to reference, to break up your course with exercises that are leading and reinforcing and providing that practice for everybody, even though you may not be teaching a class that is necessarily, that's a requirement, that helps break up the process. And having your slides aligned to the concepts that are presented in the manual so that the student can follow along, and in particular page numbers on the slide that reference the manual. Those are some of the simple but fundamental core things that I believe establish a good learning environment for the student. And if you've got language challenges, you need to have a way to solve those language challenges. And today,
for the U.S. listeners, it means just don't talk louder. That doesn't help. I've seen that way too many times. I laugh at it now, but I think it's just wrong. Sort it out before you get started.
And speaking slower doesn't necessarily help. Nope. We need to be sensitive that not everybody in every classroom can, especially in an industrial setting, as you go around the world, most importantly, they can read and write the language that the course is being conducted in. They may speak it very well, but they may not have a chance at reading anything that you're putting down. And we need to be very sensitive and cater with solid explanations of what an exercise is all about so that they have a chance. And in the classroom environment, then pre-COVID and hopefully post-COVID someday, we'll be able to walk around and work with those people.
Well, you know, I would add one more piece on here, Philip, before we wrap it up, is that part of it is, even when it's just the person in the hallway and they ask a question and you have a moment to teach, or there's a teachable moment occurs as you're walking through the plant, for example, or whatever, or you're going into the classroom or you're doing a presentation or those kind of things, is part of being ready to teach is being willing to learn how to teach. And part of that is being aware of, did the did the other person benefit from the engagement, right? Did they learn something?
Absolutely. Right?
And if they're not, you need to change. It's not their fault, right? No. You're the one with the knowledge. You're trying to hand it off. You got to deal with it. In teaching, in any moment, you have to be willing to learn yourself. And so did they get the info? Did it come across the right? Are you being effective? And then if it's not the student's fault, it's your fault. You need to change something. You need to adjust and continue to learn. Teaching in and of itself is a field as big as reliability or bigger. And dealing with other people is a field in and of itself again. So it's not that, it's obvious. And then you give them an answer. Well, that doesn't work for a lot of people. So Phil, I think we've outlined a handful of ideas here of how to be ready to teach and to continue to learn how to teach.
Be interesting to hear what others have to say, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. Some more stories. And the idea is that we help everybody teach a better course, a better hallway discussion, a better subject in the factory. And that's what it's all about. And you're absolutely right, Fred. If you assess at the end and the person that you tried to convey something to didn't get it, then we have to try harder, try something different, because what we just did didn't work.
That's right. So, you know, if you remember the days of foils and overhead projectors and you still think that's the best way to teach, let us know and why you think so. If you don't know what we're talking about, let us know and we'll send you a photo of one. Yeah. We can find it in some museum someplace. You can get a hold of us at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And Philip and I and the other hosts on the show, you can find on LinkedIn or on our About pages. So with that, I'm going to go take a look at some of my slide decks and prep that I'm doing for classes. I'm almost ready to start recording. So now I got to rethink this a little bit. So thanks, Phil. Appreciate it.
All the best, Fred. Take care. Right.
Take care. We'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.